And now, Tales from the Towpath, the story of the Manchester Ship Canal.
The decline of the city was cruel, but not for the lack of the tool. What broke the back was the lack of the means to transport her trade away to the sea. Daniel Adamson nurtured a dream to build a canal the likes never seen. And while Liverpool traders they spawned in Manchester town, the vision was born. 36 miles away from the sea. To be seen 36 miles away from the sea.
Hello, I'm Mike Harding. And this is the story of the building of the Manchester Ship Canal, or, as they call it round here, the Big Ditch. In the next hour, I'll be telling you the story of the engineers who conceived it and the incredible people who built it. With me, as you can hear, are a number of musicians. There's the Albion Band and the Bridgewater Brass Ensemble with their musical director, Gough Richards. They're going to perform music about the Ship Canal, all the songs being specially written for this programme. Also here with me are the Micron Theatre Company, who'll be helping us out with the sketches to illustrate some of the story. Because the building of the Manchester Ship Canal is a wonderful story of an incredible piece of engineering. But then you see, the whole of the Victorian era was a fantastic time for engineers. It was a time of discovery and achievement, and the engineers were totally undaunted by the large scale of the projects they undertook. You've got to remember that it was during the 19th century that the Suez Canal was built. And around the same time, they were planning the Panama Canal. So building a canal a mere 36 miles across the Cheshire countryside so that ocean-going vessels of up to 10,000 tons could get to Manchester didn't seem a particularly ridiculous idea.
We have tales from the towpath to tell you of a mighty big ditch, an adventure or two. From power-driven boats and enormous containers to tall-masted ships with their ancient retainers. Together both navvies and bankers, and soon made a path for small tugs and big tankers. The channel was fashioned with muscle and pick, and opened in style by good old Queen of England. The plunge with the suitors who bathe in their suits, or fish with the fishers who wade in their boots. You can swing on swing bridges or dock at the docks. The gateway to pleasure is pick the lock.
Let me tell you a little bit about Manchester in the 18th century. You see, at the beginning of that century, there were only around 5,000 people living in the area. It was busy. Manchester was already known for making cloth out of the local Lancashire wool and linen that had been brought over from Ireland. But it was nothing like as busy as it was going to get. Throughout the 1700s, Manchester continued to grow. And by the end of the century, it had a college, a hospital, a school and a library. There was a three-arch bridge over the River Irwell leading to Salford, and the population had grown amazingly to over 50,000. By the middle of the 19th century, Manchester was one of the main centres of the Industrial Revolution. But trouble, as always, was just around the corner. And during the 1870s, a world depression set in which hit this area very hard. And by 1880, Manchester was in decline. There was mass unemployment and people were having a pretty hard time of it. In 1884, Randolph Churchill visited the Northwest and gave a speech in Blackpool.
Order! Order! Please! Ladies and gentlemen, order, please!
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please give a warm welcome to the Northwest to Mr. Randolph Churchill!
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. The northwest of England is taking a hard blow in this depression. Your iron industry is dead as mutton. Your coal industries are languishing. Your silk industry is dead, assassinated by the foreigner. Your woolen industry is in articulo mortis, gasping, struggling. Your cotton industry is seriously sick. And as we are...
You see, the biggest problem was transport. Manchester was an inland town, a long way from the usual trade routes. The roads of Lancashire were notoriously bad. The famous Manchester wet weather made the roads quagmires of mud in winter, so at times they were almost impassable by horse and cart. It was possible to get some small boats up the River Mersey and into the Irwell, and some goods were in fact brought up the river from Liverpool that way. But the rivers could be difficult and dangerous. The locks were poorly constructed and separated by long stretches of winding river. Whenever there was a drought, which wasn't very often in Manchester, boats couldn't get up. And when there was a flood, much more likely round here, barges could be swept onto the weirs and destroyed. And in any case, the maximum tonnage you could get up the river was boats of 50 tons, just small barges. By the 1880s, Manchester was well established as a cotton town. The raw cotton came from America and was landed in Liverpool. By this time, the railways had been built too, and goods were either brought by rail or along the Mersey and Bridgewater Canal into Manchester. But the trouble was that it was all incredibly expensive. The port of Liverpool was charging high taxes on all goods brought into the port, and the railway, which was more or less owned by the same people, was also charging high transport fees.
Manchester used to look very nice in the 1700s. We had big buildings, a church, a library, about 50,000 people, a college, an hospital, a school.
Yeah, but here in Liverpool, we had our own docks, the best in Britain. We had ships coming in from all over the world, big ships. Over 900 tons they were.
Yeah, but we're the centre of the cotton industry.
Yeah, but we unload the ships from America. Send the cotton up the Mersey and Irwell navigation by barge, don't we, though?
Oh, yeah. And where was the cotton during the cotton famine, then? You didn't send anything then, did you? A lot of us in Manchester lost our jobs, we did.
Yeah, it's not our fault, though. That was an Americans fighting each other over slaves and that, though, that was. Had to do with us, then.
Oh, yeah. And another thing. You soon started charging too much money for what you did get. We were paying as much to get cotton from Liverpool as it cost to get from America.
No, you're wrong there, though, aren't you, though? It's not our fault, that there. That's the railways, that is, charging too much. Do you know, they charge twice as much as they do on the continent. They do, though.
Yeah, but you're the dearest port in the country. We can't afford to move things in and out of Liverpool. You're going to break us. Our factories are starting to close. We can't afford to move our wares.
Take it or leave it, mate.
Well, we spin and weave from morn till night. We can't get the weather away. And the foundry flare is a constant sight. But we can't get the wares away. Well, we make it fast and we make it good. But we can't get the wares away. Now it's piling up like firewood. Cause we can't get the wares away. Oh, we can't get the wares away. Away to the ships in Liverpool Bay.
just to survive, Manchester had to solve its transport problem, or the taxes being charged by Liverpool would cripple the trade of the town. A number of different ideas were proposed, and in 1882, a man called Daniel Adamson, a local businessman, called a meeting at his home in Didsbury. He wanted to discuss the possibility of building a ship link from the Mersey, which would link Manchester to the sea. Daniel Adamson was a dynamic man. Born in County Durham, he learnt his trade as an engineer working on the Stockton and Darlington Railway under that great Victorian engineer, Robert Stephenson. Adamson became an exceptional engineer, and he also had a flair for business, and after a number of years in the northeast, he moved to Stockport in 1850 to set up his own engineering works. But towards the end of the 19th century, he recognised that unless he could find a way of moving his raw materials and finished goods in and out of Manchester cheaply, then he, and many others like him, were in danger of going bankrupt. Already, many factories and houses in the town were standing empty. Adamson was not the man to take this lying down. He called a meeting at his home in Didsbury with other businessmen, and out of that meeting came a proposal to build a ship canal from the Mersey right into the heart of Manchester, a ship canal on which ocean-going vessels of up to 10,000 tons could sail right through the Cheshire countryside and straight into the heart of the city. They were literally proposing to make Manchester, 36 miles from the coast, a seaside town. At the meeting in Didsbury that night, Daniel Adamson and his companions discussed many different ideas of how best to make Manchester a seaport. Two ideas emerged. Firstly, to do major alterations to the rivers Irwell and Mersey, to straighten out some of the worst bends in the rivers and dredge all the silt out and make them deep enough to take large ships. The second idea was to build a completely new canal covering the 36 miles distance, although the biggest problem was not the distance, but the drop of 60 feet from Manchester to the Mersey estuary. This would mean the construction of many massive locks to raise the level of the water. Well, Daniel Adamson and his friends decided to ask two engineers to draw up plans for the two different ideas, and then, after carefully studying both sets of plans, they voted on which idea to put forward.
Mr. Daniel Adamson and his newly formed Manchester Tidal Navigation Company have asked me to read the nominations for the much-coveted title Engineer of the Manchester Ship Canal. The nominations are as follows. Mr. Hamilton Fulton for his plan for a tidal ship canal, and Mr. Leader Williams for his canal, which necessitates the building of locks. I know we've been waiting some months for this decision, so I'll get on with the unenviable task of opening the envelope. It is the decision of Mr. Adamson's committee and the subscribers to the Guarantee Fund that the winner is Mr. Leader Williams and his plan for the Manchester Ship Canal.
In Manchester, there was great support for the idea of a canal, as you might imagine. But the town of Liverpool, on the other hand, and the company that owned the railway link, were in violent opposition to the idea. They stood to lose a lot of money if the canal was built. But it didn't really matter what the local opinions were. Before the canal could even start being built, there were a lot of hurdles to overcome. And the first of these was, how were they going to pay for it? Also, to cut a big ditch through fields, roads and footpaths of the Cheshire countryside, the committee had to obtain parliamentary approval for the construction. Knowing there would be strong opposition from Liverpool, the committee's first job was to try and raise £100,000 to help fight to get the bill through Parliament. Support came from local trade and industry, the local government, and also local trade unions, realising that the canal would bring work and stability to the region. There were many smaller donations given by tradesmen of the area, and even from members of the general public. Here's a typical letter taken from the Manchester Guardian in that summer of 1885, showing the strength of support for the canal from the local working man.
Dear sir, I propose, as a working man, a stonemason, to give a day's wages to enable the executive committee of the Manchester Ship Canal, with their able chairman Daniel Adamson, to carry out their new scheme. And I appeal to all working men to make a similar effort. Unity is strength, and this is what our energetic committee requires at the present time.
It was a long battle. Liverpool objected strongly to the proposals. Parliament had decreed that before the work could even begin, the first £5 million of the necessary £8 million that it would take to build the canal would have to be raised within 2 years. And they said that no work was to start on the canal until the £5 million had been raised. To raise this amount of money in a depressed area at the end of the 19th century was not going to be easy. But even so, the people of Manchester and the committee were not downhearted. The bill had been passed, and this was seen as a major victory. Daniel Adamson returned to Manchester from London in triumph. He was greeted by large crowds of cheering town folk. In Eccles, an ox roast and civic procession was held in his honour, and to commemorate the event on October the 3rd, 1885, 60,000 people marched from Piccadilly to Bellevue to praise the leaders of the project.
Ladies and gentlemen, after the heady news from London, we have all been drunk on victory. Let us now turn to the next task facing us in our struggle. 2 years we have, and 2 years only, to raise £5 million. I know every man, woman and child in Lancashire will contribute all they can to this great scheme. Take care you do not miss this unique opportunity. We will build this canal from the sea to Manchester. I believe it will bring much work and prosperity to our beleaguered factories and mills. This canal will make Manchester once again a great industrial town.
Adamson actually believed he could raise the money from public donations. He thought that the working men and women of the Northwest, realising that the canal would help to save Manchester, would put in a couple of pounds here and there, and this would raise the money. But it was just too big a sum to raise in this manner. And also there was terrible class snobbery in Britain at that time. The people with real money, the upper classes, weren't going to invest money in a project fronted by a normal working man. And despite Daniel Adamson's success in business, his parents had been lowly shopkeepers. This wasn't going to get the gentry to put their hands in their pockets.
Come along, Nethys, dear. Do some dawdling.
Oh, Aunt Begonia. These are such stirring times. First the news from London when Mr. Adamson and his supporters carried the day, and then the public holiday. Oh, what a colourful celebration.
Nethys, dear. Sometimes your wanton enthusiasm for the world of tradesmen and engineers leaves me astounded.
But all!
But me no buts, Lettuce, dear. Stop waving your hand around. In any case, this drunken frivolity is a little premature. Mr. General Adamson now only has 18 months to raise £5 million from his precious shopkeepers and bootblackers.
No, poor Mr. Adamson.
Indeed, poor Mr. Adamson. He does not have the financial standing necessary for an undertaking of this sort. After all, Lettuce, dear, these great matters of commerce cannot just be left to the tradespeople and merchants to spoil, can they, dear?
No, Aunt Begonia.
Daniel Adamson had been mistaken. By October 1885, he'd only managed to raise £150,000. Time was running out. Concerned by these failures, the company asked the Lord Mayor of Manchester, Alderman P. Goldschmidt, for his advice. He recommended that some well-known public figures should be elected onto the board of the company to help to attract money from big investors. Daniel Adamson, who still believed that money could and should be raised from the general public, reacted badly to the decision.
Gentlemen, in view of recent events, I feel I have no other option but to retire most regretfully from the board. I wish the canal every success and hope that the capital may soon be got. I know that it will be if the matter is properly pursued. And there will be nobody who will rejoice more than I shall when at last you get to work.
So Daniel Adamson, the dynamic frontman who'd brought the project thus far, resigned from the committee. And his place as chairman of the board was taken by the well-respected and very rich Lord Edgerton of Tatton.
Oh, Lettice! I'm so glad that Lord Edgerton has been voted chairman. And such a nice man. I may be induced to risk some of my own late papa's capital.
Your papa was a cheesemonger, was he not, Aunt Begonia?
Be quiet, Lettice, dear. With only 1 month to go, they would be glad of the money, however accumulated. Now it's all in such good hands, it's time for us to show a little support.
With just days left to go on the 2-year deadline, the money, the £5 million, was raised, and work on the canal could start. The first job was to find an engineer to run the construction. It was decided that Thomas Andrew Walker was the man for the job. Walker was 60 years old and had a lifetime of experience in Victorian engineering. He'd built the Severn Railway Tunnel and several of the new London Underground Railways. He was also regarded as an excellent employer who looked after his workforce. Most of the route was a long way from towns, so there were relatively few places to house the 17,000 men, women and boys who were going to work on the digging of the big ditch. So to solve the problem, Walker constructed a number of temporary villages along the length of the canal to house his workers. These villages of wooden huts were proper little communities, centred round a meeting hall which was used as a schoolroom during the day, a dance hall on Saturday nights, and a mission hall on Sundays. The village of Bigfield near Runcorn became one of the largest navvy settlements in Britain. Often, a ganger and his wife would rent a large hut and then take in numbers of single men and charge them rent. It was these gangers' wives that held the fabric of these communities together. They would teach the children in the school and do the cooking, washing and cleaning for their husbands, sons and even the lodgers.
They built this house for those who work upon the great canal. I am the ganger's wife. I serve them all, they treat me well. There's Gang John and I, and the man he works beside. Brothers to each other, sons to me. Once I saw no future, no family. Sundays at the mission. children learn to read their everyday. But when Saturday comes around, it's to the mission hall we're out to dance and laugh the working week away.
Building the canal was going to take at least 4 years, and Thomas Walker realised that if the men were going to be able to go home and rest in a proper community, it was going to make for a better working life, and there would be less trouble with his workforce. So far, there had been no major problems. The biggest difficulty had been during the summer months, when local farmers had enticed some of the labour force away to help with the harvest by supplying them with unlimited amounts of free beer. But time was made up by working nights by lamplight. The sight of this amazing construction began to attract a lot of attention. The progress that had been made during the Victorian age had made available some of the first great steam-driven machines and trains to move the earth, but even so, manpower was still the main moving force. Thousands of navvies sweated away in the deep, long hole that was to be the ship canal. And people came from far and wide to watch, realising that this was probably going to be the last major earth-moving project in the Western world to be done mainly by hand.
Right, you lot. Take a look at this trench. 16,000 men and boys working this big ditch. I'm Sam Hall. I'm 93, you know. Okay, got a job as a watchman. Got work to do. We've got visitors. More bloody tourists.
Oh, Grace, come along. Look at this. It's all quite stupendous.
Oh, Basil, it's breathtaking. What are those little boys doing?
Livers, Mom. Some of them 7 or 8 years old. They run and carry, Mom. Think that one? He's taking a bloody pick to the blacksmith's for resharpening.
They're so little and skinny.
When they get to be 10, they become fat boys.
I can't see any fat boys.
No. No, sir. They're called fat boys because they slither about in the mud under the wagons, greasing the axles and wheel hubs.
Yes, well, that's very interesting. And, darling, I think we should be moving on.
The older boys get to be spraggers and tippers. Yeah, when they reach 18, they get to fill the wagons. I remember that day when I filled my first wagon. Yes. Pouring down, it were.
Jolly interesting. Darling, I think we should have some tea.
A lot of the men look very strong and muscular.
Yeah, well, it takes a year to trim a flabby labourer into a man hard enough to work his shift in a muck-shoveling gang. You've got to know how to handle your body.
Oh?
My word, look at the time of
it. Once you bend your back at blowing upside, you don't straighten it again, do yo-ho. You have to know how to mine timber, how best to pick, blast, drill, shovel all kinds of muck from rock to sand, clay to loam. I've seen men exert themselves so violently in their work that blood has oozed out of their eyes and nostrils.
It's a fine sight. All those men stripped to their waists in the heat of the day. So many men.
Darling, I insist we must go.
Look, Crowbar, Nobby, Black Joe, Bible John, Crooked Arm, Jaggy, Cheshire George, Dog Belly, Cider, Tommy, Virgin Slanty, Devil Driving George.
They all sound so romantic. Ooh, what's all that commotion down there?
There's nothing romantic about accidents.
Dear.
In the big ditch were great big steam machines, railway locomotives and excavating equipment, working alongside men and boys digging with picks and shovels. Much of the work was done by hand, and inevitable with an engineering project of this size, there were a number of accidents. It was noted that during the construction, there were 1,292 accidents, 130 of them fatal, and 165 resulting in permanent disability. It's hardly surprising that there were accidents, because there were masses of primitive steam-driven machines and thousands of labourers working side by side, the men struggling up the side of the cut with their loads of earth and rocks. For much of the soil could only be taken out of the canal by wheelbarrows up constructions called rope walks. These were planks of wood laid up the steep sides of the excavation. A barrow full of earth, rocks and clay was attached to a rope, which was pulled by a horse standing at the top of the cut. The navvy walked behind up the plank, guiding the barrow. It was slippy and dangerous, but even so, 60 barrows an hour could be taken out this way. Many navvies toppled off, the loaded barrow falling on top of them. It was incredibly difficult and dangerous. Thomas Walker, the chief engineer of the Ship Canal Company, was generally considered to be a good employer for the harsh Victorian times. He provided homes and hospitals for the workforce. He paid reasonably well, between £1 to 25 shillings a week, depending on age and experience, and the working day was only 10 hours. He also had a policy of continuing to employ men who'd been disabled by accidents on the site, something unheard of in the Victorian era. So the work continued pretty much trouble-free for the first 2 years. Then the problems started. In November 1889, Thomas Walker died. and very quickly the directors of the company realized how hard he was going to be to replace. It had been Walker's outstanding ability and experience as an engineer, and his good relationship with the workforce that had kept the work on course and prevented many major accidents and hold-ups. Then, in January 1890, the weather took a turn for the worse. Severe frost held up the work on the dams and locks, and then torrential rain flooded the rivers Mersey and Irwell, and the temporary dams that had separated the canal from the rivers burst, and entire sections of the works were flooded. At Lym, the river came in with such force that it carried away many of the temporary bridges that had been built to help with the construction. The timber from the first bridge was swept down the canal and became battering rams, knocking down all the other bridges. The water covered steam navvies and cranes, and at Lum Brook, a team of men working on their steam engine barely managed to scramble to the top of the bank before a great tidal wave swept down the workings and submerged their locomotive. Huts, tools and equipment were covered by up to 30 feet of water, and thousands of men were thrown out of work. To make matters worse, the weather turned colder as winter deepened and the whole flood froze over. This was the most severe weather since the project had started. On some sections of the canal, work would not begin again until April of the following year.
When the floods came in, showed no mercy on that day. When the floods came in, broke the bridges down and washed them all away.
When the floods came in,
it was a heavy price to pay. So many went down, so many men drowned in the big
Severe weather and the floods delayed the work on the canal for many months. The cost of repairs and the draining of the cut made it inevitable that the canal would go well over budget. It also looked as if it was going to take much longer to build than they first estimated, but there was no more money available in the kitty. Manchester Council could see the advantages that the ship canal would bring to the area, and so they gave £3 million from the city funds so that work could continue. And then a year later, they dug deep again and gave another £2 million. From the first estimate of £8 million, the canal was eventually going to cost £15 million, and it would take 6 years to finish rather than the estimated 4 years. However, the construction would completely revitalise Manchester, and the canal would bring trade and prosperity to the area that had been undreamed of 20 years earlier.
Cause £3 million was raised. Boys,
Guarantee of more money from the Manchester City Council, work on the canal continued, and in late 1891, water from the River Mersey was allowed into the cut, and the first part of the canal was opened. Temporary docks were built at Saltport near Frodsham, and in November the merchant ship Helm, a ship of over 4,700 tons, entered the canal and reached Saltport, 11 miles up the canal. The dream of Daniel Adamson was beginning to become true. Through 1892 and 1893, the work continued on the rest of the canal, and further sections were opened. Difficulties were overcome, and gradually bridges and locks were put into place. The most spectacular piece of engineering being the construction of a swing aqueduct to carry the Bridgewater Canal over the new ship canal. This was an amazing piece of engineering, which literally put the barges travelling the Bridgewater Canal into a giant metal tub, which closed at both ends and carried barge and canal water over the Manchester Ship Canal by swinging the contents over and connecting the tub to the other side, opening the doors and letting the barges float into the Bridgewater and off on their journey. And so the big day came, and on December the 7th, 1893, the directors of the Manchester Ship Canal Company boarded the steamship Snowdrop and made the first trip up the full length of the canal, from Prince's Dock in Liverpool, up the Mersey, into the canal at Eastham, and onto Pomona Docks, Salford. The 36 miles took 8 hours to complete, and they stopped off along the way to examine the locks and bridges. At the end of the journey, the chairman announced the trip to have been a splendid success, and the canal was to be open to all traffic on January the 1st, 1894. One of the first public ships to make the trip was chartered by the Manchester Arts Club, and one of their member poets wrote this little epic.
To cross no mighty ocean, to seek no foreign shore, the merchant ships of England their anchors weigh once more. Today they sail our ship canal, they celebrate the worth of British pluck and energy, this triumph of the North. The silver streak they sail today was made by British hands. No foreign workmen did the work, no mercenary bands. But British brains devised the scheme and carried out the plan. Brave Adamson and Walker, who so nobly led the van. And if some did depreciate the work when first begun, they surely will not stint their praise now that the work is done. But wish Godspeed with all our hearts, and work with willing hand, that trade and commerce may increase and prosper through the land. And Manchester and Liverpool, their merchant fleets combined, new markets may discover, fresh benefits bring mankind. Long may their commerce prosper, their full sails ne'er be furled, not till old England's sun be set, the death knell of the world.
The months
Although the canal was open to traffic on January the 1st, 1894, it was agreed that there should be an official opening, and Queen Victoria agreed to come to Manchester to do the honours. On May the 21st, good Queen Vic came up from London by train to what is now Piccadilly Station and took a carriage to the Town Hall, where all the dignitaries waited to meet her. After all the official speeches, the presentations and the civic backslapping, she went to Salford Docks and boarded the steamer Enchantress. She sat in a high throne at the back of the boat, and they steamed off to Mode Wheel Lock, where she pressed a button to open the gates and formally declared the Manchester Ship Canal to be open.
I trust Manchester may never cease to be prosperous and thrive, and that all classes and subjects may share in the benefits attending on the success of this most important enterprise. I now have great pleasure in declaring the Manchester Ship Canal open. Right, shall we knight somebody now?
As she opened the lock, there was a 21-gun salute, and then the Queen knighted the Lord Mayor of Manchester and the Mayor of Salford, presumably because they were standing closer to her, because as far as I know, they'd nothing to do with building the canal. Anyway, after all the jollies and the tea and buns, good Queen Vic left Manchester and caught the train back to London. Everyone had a good day out, and the big ditch was officially open. Manchester, my hometown, is in many ways unique. It's an inland city, but within a mile of its centre you can find ocean-going ships of over 10,000 tonnes coming here from all over the world. But be in no doubt, if it hadn't been for the foresight of such men as Daniel Adamson, the brilliance of engineers like Thomas Walker, and the sweat and toil of 17,000 navvies who together brought the canal to Manchester, this city would certainly not be the capital of the Northwest as it is today. It would probably be a second-rate town of little importance. The success of Manchester and its surrounding towns is built on the trade brought to the area by the canal. In the last hour, we've merely scratched the surface of the stories, the dreams, and the heartache that went into the construction of the Big Ditch. The canal is still open today, and only last year, over 1 million tons of goods were landed at Trafford Park, which are now the main docks for the area. On the site of the old docks at Salford Quays, the buildings are being redeveloped, and posh flats and businesses are now appearing on the dockside. But if you wander down there, you can still feel the atmosphere and sense the ghosts of the thousands of men and women who work there, and the ships with their loads of timber, spices, grain, and of course, the raw cotton that came into the city from all over the world.
Adamson, he made a vow in 1887. He built the greatest ship canal if he the man was given. 16,000 raised their hands and dug a ditch to Merseysands. Then to the sound of marching bands they claimed a modern marvel. A century has passed away since came the son of Adam, and water trade has given way to miles of tarmac Adam. But water parks and office blocks have risen from neglected docks, and newly renovated lots are now a modern marvel. Should you go by Salford the keys upon a summer's evening. I'll stroll around in Castlefield as pleasure boats are leaving. Close your eyes, recall the scene when all around was clothed in green. Till 16,000 abbeys keen carved out of modern marble.
If anyone was to say today, I know, why not take a small inland town, say Nantwich, which is about the same distance from the sea as Manchester, and let's build a canal and make it into the biggest port in Britain outside of London? Well, people would probably think you were barmy. And I don't know. Maybe the people who built the Manchester Ship Canal were barmy. But even if they were, this programme has been a tribute to them, to those men and women who made the canal, not just the movers and shakers and the leaders, but the 17,000 people who, with not much more than picks and shovels, enabled ocean-going ships to travel 36 miles inland and quite literally brought the sea to Manchester.
The decline of the city was cruel, but not for the lack of the tomb. What broke the back transporter trade away to the sea. Daniel Adamson nurtured a dream to build a canal the likes never seen. And while the traders in Liverpool scorned, in Manchester town the vision was born. 36 miles away from the sea, a sight to be seen. 36 miles away from the sea. Well, the money and time, it was tight, but Manchester rose to the fight. And as the deadline dissolved in 2 days, resolved to the cause, boys and men, 16,000 in all, from town and country they answered the call, to work 60 hours a week for a pound, removing the earth, to channel the ground. 36 miles away from the sea, building a turned to years till 94 came. And how Manchester gathered with glee when Victoria opened the key. Manchester city would rise once again, city of dreams. Your ship has come in. 36 sight to be seen. 36 miles, 36 miles away from the sea, building a dream, a gateway, a key, from the sea to the city. What a sight to be seen. 36 miles away from the sea. Thank you.
Tales from the Towpath, the story of the building of the Manchester Ship Canal, was narrated by Mike Harding. The songs and music were written by Julie Matthews, Chris Weil, Ashley Hutchings, and Joe Broughton, and performed by the Albion Band and the Bridgewater Brass Ensemble, conducted by Gough Richards. The sketches were performed by the Micron Company, who are Mike Lucas, Yashti McLachlan, Joanne McGowan, Richard Poble, and Edmund Harcourt. The programme was written by John Leonard and was a Smooth Operations production.